On Tech News Today, HTC ships a new Windows phone, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission gets hacked, and Google wants to roll out Gmail and YouTube accounts for kids. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, August 19th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. With me is Jason Howell behind the controls. Now, yesterday you anchored TN2, Tech News Tonight.
Yeah.
And your most bleeding-edge story was that the Flappy Bird creator Dong Yen created an iOS app called Swingcopters.
Wow. Wow, it's amazing. It follows pretty much the same exact game mechanics as Flappy Bird.
Yeah.
Except that you hit again. In order to switch sides, and it goes vertical. He obviously had something going with Flappy Bird that people loved. I, for one, installed Flappy Bird and uninstalled it about 5 minutes later. It's like, okay, I get it. I'm not going to get roped into this thing. So who knows? He might have a slam dunk here too, but it kind of seems like that trick you can only play so many times. Maybe he can play it this time, but the next time he's probably got to widen his game a little bit more than
succeeding
that.
Like he did once is a one in a million shot.
Yeah, that's true.
Succeeding twice is pretty much, his chances are zero, essentially. But helicopters,
there
Jason,
you go.
Helicopters is so much
better.
And
swinging hammers.
That's right, so. That's right. Everybody loves swinging hammers. Speaking of swinging hammers, Joe Panettiere is our co-anchor today.
And nice every transition.
That kind of worked.
That's right. The Thor, the god of technology news. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing fantastic. How you been, Mike?
I've been great. And you were telling me before the show that you're going to be hunting for additional props. You have prop envy because we have some good props coming up in this show.
Yeah, so. I'm actually hunting around right now because I lost a couple. But I'm actually going down to Disney World with one of my sons in a few days. So, we've got the R2 unit back there. We'll see what else we can dig up down in Walt Disneyland.
Maybe you can get a Software Pirates of the Caribbean hat or something like that.
Yeah, I could use a hat or two or three.
All right, well, let's jump into the news. We have lots of it and lots of interview guests today. HTC this morning announced a new Windows phone. It's called the HTC One M8 for Windows. And here to tell us all about it is Mashable tech editor Pete Paschal. Welcome, Pete.
What's up?
How you doing? We got a lot of news today, and you got a lot of hardware in hand. So let's just jump right into this story. This is a rumored device, and it's probably pretty good news. How similar is this phone to the Android HTC One M8?
On the outside, completely similar. I actually have both models here. You can maybe see it's like, okay, this is the Windows one and this is the Android one. And you can see there's just that little Windows phone logo that sort of betrays what's on this one.
I assume that the Windows one is heavier because there's more software inside.
Exactly. No, they feel exactly the same. And if you flip them around, there you go. Now that you can tell which one is which. This is obviously the new guy. It's pretty cool. I mean, the HTC One M8, that's this year's model, was very well received as an Android phone. And the idea is to get that sort of special sauce to play up the Windows phone platform a little bit. And they've done a good job in sort of translating a lot of the features that are sort of signature on the HTC One for Android. There's a camera that has the two parts to it. So it's the duo camera. That top sensor there records depth information. And by doing that, you can do cool things like you can take a photo and refocus it after the fact, kind of like a Lytro image. And it does a really good job of it because it's not just using software. It's actually using optical information too. There's the IR port still built into the power button on the top. Windows Phone actually doesn't support that kind of stuff, sort of just for any developer who wants to do it. So HTC had to work pretty closely with Microsoft to make sure that their TV app, which they've reimagined for Windows Phone, still works on this model. It also has Blink Feed, which is the sort of snackable data that you get. I haven't actually set mine up. I've actually just come back from the event with this phone. But it works also on the Windows Phone version. It's just, it used to be you would sweep. Here's my home screen on the other one. You sweep this way, and there's Blink Feed. You can't swipe on the Windows Phone version. It's just sort of relegated to an app. So they've done a good job of translating that sort of HTC One magic over, plus adding some cool Microsoft features. Here's Cortana.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, in terms of adding those quote-unquote cool features, is there anything new that HTC has introduced here? Like, for the first time, certain software that they've written, is it first on Windows and then they'll bring it to Android? Or is it more a case of a lot of the Android features they've already developed coming over to Windows?
Yeah, they're not messing with success. There's not really a new signature HTC thing that they're doing specifically for Windows, because a lot of that stuff was kind of built into HTC Sense, their skin for Android. So it's really like to reverse engineer that is kind of a big deal. Some of the stuff works a little differently. So if you say go into the camera, so here's the HTC camera, la, la, la. And if you go into this, so, okay, you see there on the camera where you pick your different cameras, there's one called Lenses, and that's part of the Windows Phone software. Lenses aren't like physical lenses. Those are apps that will actually work with the camera app that you can call up, like an Instagram or a Pixlr, and they'll just appear in that list of lenses when you call up the camera. It is in the Android version, but that's sort of inherent to Windows Phone. And, you know, it can be pretty cool if you like to experiment with different kinds of apps and photo features.
Now, the Wall Street Journal's Joanna Stern called this yet another great phone you won't buy. And that's kind of looking at it from the perspective of market share. Of course, Windows Phone has a very small market share. But for the Windows Phone fans out there, of which there are a few million, this is big news because this is the first non-Nokia phone to come out on the Windows Phone platform in quite a while. And this is a great phone. People love this phone. Do you think this is going to change people's minds to convert over to Windows Phone? People maybe who are fed up with iOS or something like that and don't want to go to Android? Or do you think this is just going to be something, a new way to divide up the already small Windows Phone pie?
No, I think it's going to convince some people. The HTC One is a very good phone. It's well-received. I think it got really great reviews from pretty much everybody, including me. Some of those features are... actually my favorite feature on the HTC One isn't on Windows Phone, which is actually the Zoe camera, which works to create highlight videos of everything you're photographing. So if you take a bunch of photos and videos around an event, it'll automatically create a highlight video with all that stuff. That's actually not on the Windows Phone version, which is a shame. But that's not, you know, the HTC One M8 doesn't live and die by that feature alone. This is a great phone. There's not a ton of great phablets on Windows Phone right now. There's the Nokia 1520 and I believe the 1320. And so this is offering like a flagship level phablet on Windows Phone to anyone who wants one. Then it doesn't have some of the design issues that the Nokia one has, where, you know, it's got that gloss finish. It's sometimes a little hard to hold. It's a little smaller than that phone. So I think this has the potential to win some people over onto the Windows Phone side. I don't think it's just going to be Windows Phone fans. I think you're going to see people like, oh, wow, that's actually a great phone. For whatever reason, Windows Phone, I'm giving Windows Phone a look, because this phone actually has what I need, particularly if it's phablet size, that could mean better traction overseas. Of course, they haven't announced overseas launches yet, but I think we can be pretty confident that that's coming in the near future.
Hey, Pete, what about pricing and availability on this?
Yeah, as I said, it's only in the U.S. They're launching it in the U.S., and it's exclusive on Verizon. So fortunately, the out-of-the-gate price is pretty good. It's $99.99, so $100 with a two-year contract. And, of course, you can also buy it on one of the contract-free plans that all the carriers offer now, Verizon Edge, which I believe it's in the neighborhood of $20 to $25. I'm not exactly sure. But the Verizon exclusivity will certainly hurt this phone a bit out of the gate. because, you know, obviously you want it on all the carriers if you really want to get that traction. But Verizon was recently rated as one of the best carriers out there, and they're certainly a behemoth. So, you know, as carriers go, if you had to go with one, they did okay.
All right, well, Pete Paschal, please stick around. We're going to bring you back in for another story in just a few minutes. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Not just you, Pete. I want to tell everybody about Squarespace. Squarespace is really well known as a place where you can build a website that can't be brought down. It's also well known as a place where you can build a website that is beautiful and beautifully designed. And it's also well known as a place where you can build professional quality e-commerce. However, it should be known as the best place to do a blog. You want to build a blog, you want to have your own URL, your own branding, your own visuals, your own control of the entire blog, Squarespace is the place to do it. They have a layout engine-based editing, markdown support. You can even post by email. That's a really rare feature that I personally love. Of course, RSS syndication. I still believe in RSS, and they'll just give it to you right out of the box. And geotagging, so many great blogging features. And I recommend that everybody who is currently not publishing a blog, you should be publishing a blog. Publishing a blog is probably one of the best things you could ever do because it really enables you to explore what you're really passionate about, what you're really interested in, and then you can, over time, gather community around those interests, and it's a super gratifying thing, and it's easy to do. If you've already got a blog, simply import your existing blog, and you can bring it in from all kinds of other blogging platforms very, very easily. It also supports a configurable sharing button, so you can, you know, one button click sharing on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, LinkedIn, StumbleUpon, Reddit, Pinterest, and Tumblr, all the major sites. Entry scheduling lets you schedule entries, so you can write 3 blog posts at once, but have them dribble out every few hours, so you're not overwhelming your readers with a big rush of stories. RSS blocks make it easy for visitors to add your feed to their newsreader by simply clicking on a subscribe button, and you can put that button anywhere on your website, and you can publish blog entries with multiple author attributions. So if you want to collaborate on your blog or have guest bloggers temporarily write on your blog, it's super easy to do, and it'll just add their name and link and information automatically based on their login. So you don't really, once you set it up, you don't have to do anything additional to support multiple author attribution. You're not going to, in my experience, you don't need much help to use Squarespace. It's so intuitive and so easy to use. But if you do need help, if you would like some help, they have tech support 24/7 via chat or email, and they have great support. This is one of the best support things I've ever seen. They really know what they're talking about. And Squarespace sounds expensive, but it starts at just $8 a month. And that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So what are you waiting for? Start your free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. That'll get you 10% off the price, and it will also show your support for Tech News Today. Well, Joe, it looks like we have some kind of a digital China syndrome going on. What's the latest hack? What is the hack of the day?
The hack of the day is actually a 3-year hack. And this, let's start with the big picture. What if nuclear reactors suffered a digital meltdown? Now, fortunately, that has not happened. But in the past 3 years, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission computers were successfully hacked by foreigners roughly twice, and also by an unidentified individual a third time. And this comes from nextgov.com. So, you know, for me, Mike, we certainly have some details about this particular hack or series of hacks, but I think the bigger picture here involves protecting critical U.S. infrastructure, the power grid, communication networks, transportation networks, financial networks, and healthcare networks. And it seems to me like the international quote-unquote espionage when it comes to hacking is going after all this critical infrastructure at this point. And I'm not quite sure that the U.S. is ready to put up the digital defense across all these systems.
Do you have a sense of, I mean, you know, we cover these stories day after day. They're just one hack after another. Everything is being hacked. Right. Yesterday, we talked about a big hospital being hacked, you know, multiple hospitals being hacked, all this medical related information, or at least the personal information of patients being sort of hoovered up and taken off somewhere into China. We see so many of these hacks, and it seems like nothing can be protected. What is the larger solution to these kinds of attacks? I mean, it seems like the federal government isn't doing anything. Private industry isn't doing anything. You see the security companies talking a lot, but usually that is all about scaring people into using their services or using their products.
Right.
And yet, you know, it's just one thing after another with these massive hacks that, you know, go into scary infrastructure like the nuclear, you know, who knows what they've got, what sort of secrets they can piece together from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is the solution itself is a problem at this point. And what I mean by that is look at a company like Kaspersky Lab. To their credit, they're an antivirus company. But if you go to their conferences, if you read their online content, they have talked about protecting critical infrastructure for years. And they've been developing an operating system, sort of a purpose-built operating system, not a Windows, not a Linux, but this core code that the infrastructure companies or organizations could run their systems on, like you could run a power plant, all their applications on top of this. The problem is, number one, the code from Kaspersky isn't quite ready yet. Number two, Kaspersky itself is a company that was founded in Russia. So, of course, for better or for worse, U.S. organizations are going to be concerned that this code was actually written by a Russian company.
And the other problem is, of course, the weakest link in almost any security chain are the users. And right. This is another case where something like a dozen employees got suckered in by a phishing link. And that's always going to happen. You can always socially engineer people. And so that's one of the least appreciated factors in almost any sort of hack, that it's always almost always a combination of social engineering and, you know, hacking and cracking skills.
Yeah, you almost wonder when email systems and communication systems will actually flag. You know, you can't always tell. It's difficult to tell what is a phishing message and what isn't in many cases. But on the other hand, could communication systems, email systems, at least flag things that say, hey, this is from a user you haven't dealt with before or from an IP address that you haven't dealt with before? So it's not saying, hey, this is a phishing message, but it's at least flagging it for you so that you have that point of hesitation to say, wait a minute, am I going to proceed or not proceed here? And why would I proceed?
Yeah, what that will do, though, is that will train the crackers to make sure that they establish a rapport with you in advance so that you are a known user. And, of course, we've seen Facebook using the we don't know who you are method to deep six messages. For example, if you send a message to anyone on Facebook and you've never messaged them before, your message will go into a folder called the other folder, which almost nobody checks. And by the way, right. If you want to entertain yourself, go to Facebook, go into the messaging area, find the other folder, and look at all the messages you missed. And in many cases, you're likely to be shocked by the messages you missed. And people often are. But it seems to me that there has to be a separation between any sort of web surfing and the system that is gaining access to the corporate networks. So, for example, what I think we need is some method by which you get a phishing link, and instead of just clicking on it and opening a browser right there on the system that's logged in and everything, you essentially carry that URL over to a sandboxed or a different system or some way that you can go to the website, and then from that window, there's no access to the corporate networks. That right. Something like that has to be a standard operating procedure, because as long as the user is logged into networks that have sensitive information, and as long as you can execute anything, including just opening a web browser, these things are going to happen.
Yeah. You know, and then you extend that one step beyond the corporate systems. Take it to the consumer systems, where so many of us are now working from home, including myself. When is it that the ISPs are going to stand up and say, hey, in order to use our service, you have to have at least these minimal security checks in place on your system before you can even connect to the public network? I mean, and I think there's some healthy debate there. You don't want the ISP going so far, but do you at least want a minimum barrier to entry before everyone's hopping on broadband? And the other thing we all have to watch here is the feds on the flip side going after the ISPs. Anytime there is a hack of this point, the ISPs are ultimately scrambling to reply to requests for information, et cetera, on where the hacks came from. So it's a mess, I think, both on the consumer side, the ISP side, and then the corporate provider, the actual corporate network.
Well, it's an interesting new development, but it's not surprising because these kinds of stories are coming out almost every day. And so we can expect lots more in the days and weeks and months ahead. Somebody's got to do something. Maybe, Joe, you and I should launch our own security company. It seems to be good work if you can get it. There's plenty of it.
I've got that name. I've got that title, entrepreneur, in my name. So I better started on something soon. Otherwise, people will say I'm bluffing.
Well, in somewhat lighter news, or maybe it's heavier news, a company called Fuhu just unveiled some big Android tablets, really big. One's got a 24-inch screen, and the other one's got a 20-inch screen. They're called Big Tab tablets, and they're aimed at kids and families. So we're going to bring back in Pete Paschal, the tech editor for Mashable. Welcome back, Pete. We missed you.
Happy to be back.
So tell us about these tablets. Why are they so darn large?
Well, I'm appropriately bigger now for this.
Perfect.
Well, they're large because that's actually an ideal size for sharing an experience, particularly games. So if you think about how we used to encounter board games like Monopoly, and the things like that, you know, it's a big game board. And to do that, capture that virtually, I mean, an iPad or even something as big as like a Surface Pro isn't going to quite cut it. You need something huge. And that was the logic here. Also, you know, kids obviously aren't going to be quite as precise, particularly small children, in terms of their touch. And it also opens up a lot of possibilities to use the tablet as, say, an easel and the stand. They actually come with an easel-like stand, so you can easily sort of push it up and start sort of doing some painting in a painting program. So they really thought about the optimal experience for both small children, everyday children, and families at large. And it's pretty good. I've used one, the 20-inch one. I did a little air hockey on it. You can actually do it. You can actually sort of do some very fast, sort of quick movements on it and, you know, not fly off the screen right away or interfere with your the person you're playing against. They've thought out the experience pretty well.
Hey, Pete, Joe here. Quick question for you. You mentioned that game experience and the board game experience. I think that's a great metaphor for this. I've been watching for more than a year now. Lenovo has something called the Idea Center Horizon. I think that's a 27-inch Windows 8 big tablet, obviously. But they have air hockey on that. They have Monopoly on it. But I never quite bought it because of the price tag. I think the price tag on that is something like $1,500. Do you think the tablets you're talking about here can open up the market more rapidly thanks to an aggressive pricing and maybe some more interactive games on them?
Yeah, I think it's a better approach. They're not that cheap. It is a $550 for the 24-inch and about $450 for the 20-inch. So you're looking at iPad territory here. But, I mean, parents are already buying tablets for their kids in this price range. This actually has a great potential to compete with those kind of buys. Now, the Idea Center Horizon, I've used that too. That's actually a great rig. It even comes with some accessories that, you know, digitally work with the screen, right? So you actually have an air hockey thing to use it. The problem is, you're right. I mean, you could probably buy three actual air hockey tables for that much, at least, you know. You have to sort of get it into this range, which I think these tablets get to for at least some people. Now, could they have gone cheaper? Yes. I mean, you know, they could have put it in sort of a lousier processor, take down the resolution. They didn't. These are actually pretty good tabs. They both have a powered by Tegra 4 processor, so that's not bad. It's not quite the K1, but I mean it's very snappy for games like this and doing sort of storybook experiences. So they're not junk, and you could even, like, you know, once the kids go to bed, you could potentially just prop that on your lap and do some work or some second screen experiences on your 20-inch tablet. So, you know, it's not a terrible take on this space, and it is overcoming at least a little that price barrier. If they can get it down even more through discounts, deals, exclusive retail partnerships, I think it could do even better.
I mean, I actually thought that $549 for the 24-inch tablet is pretty cheap. That's cheaper than an iPhone.
And, I agree.
And if you think about just a screen that has no intelligence and no touch on it, you know, that's going to be in the ballpark of, you know, $200-$300 maybe. Now, this, let's drill into some of the functionality that they built in into this to make it family and kid friendly. They have what they call five modes. So one of them is called two play. We can play checkers, chess, backgammon, and other games. Another one's called game room, air hockey, which you mentioned, and board games. A third mode is called Showtime, which has a pack of pre-selected apps and games from Disney, Cartoon Network, Cookie Jar Entertainment. There's Story Time that has 35 interactive ebooks, and Big Canvas, which is for, you know, virtual paints, crayons, pens, and more. I love this idea, and I also like the idea of having, you know, multiple screens like this. I mean, you can imagine this bolted to the freezer door or something like that instead of the magnet notes and calendars and things that people tend to put onto the refrigerators, make it all digital. Leave messages for each other or whatever. Watch TV if you want to do that. Watch YouTube videos. I love the idea of these big screen, relatively inexpensive devices, but I fear that people just are not ready for it mentally. They think of tablets, you know, people are excited about 7 and 8 inch tablets these days. And, you know, the 10 inch tablets are kind of less popular nowadays, but that's kind of the maximum size that people think of when they think of tablets. I don't see any reason why you don't have these gigantic tablets. And, of course, Android makes that possible. It's built in. Android can be used for tablets of any size, literally.
Yeah, they've even demoed, not for sale, but tablets as large as 65 inches. And really, Android is an OS. You could put it in a projector, and they have. Philips and a few others of market projectors that are powered by Android. You can go even bigger. So, yeah, Android tablets, I definitely agree with you that the hot sector the last couple of years has been the smaller tablets, and we've seen the phones sort of catch up to that. That's if you're looking for a very specific experience, which I think is most people's familiarity. You need that mobility. That's the emphasis of the market, and I think it always will be. I think there is the potential for a market of these larger screen devices. And, you know, we've mentioned the Idea Center. There's also Sony has their, or at least used to have their Vios, that the big screen Windows sort of tablet-esque things that you can haul from room to room with similar functionality. I think Android has a better chance of winning this space, though, simply because, as we've already mentioned, the cost factor. And kids with their, you know, by targeting kids, you're kind of getting them early because they haven't quite figured out the experiences they want. So if you get a tablet like this, you put it in your playroom and you walk your kid through one or two of these things, I think there's going to be this, oh, I get it. This is the game thing. And I can, you know, pick it up, move it from room to room, you know, sit down with mommy in this room or sit down with my brother in this room and bring it to bed even, and, you know, go through a storybook, and this is like my experience. And that, you know, I don't think that's ever going to quite catch up to the, you know, the mobility side of things, but I think there's a market that's untapped.
Yeah. Hey, Pete, one final quick question on this. When I look at this, I keep wondering when does the tablet get a little bit bigger and start to resemble the original Microsoft Surface, which was that big coffee table looking type of setup. But what I would like to see is a super large screen built into a custom coffee table, so it becomes a gathering place in your living room where when friends stop by, they're actually taking a look at this. And it almost becomes the next generation TV, where the family used to gather around the TV. Now they're gathering around this quote-unquote coffee table. Do you see custom furniture and those types of things emerging around this as natural accessories?
I could see it for a certain type of customer. They, you know, the Surface ended up being more of a retail assist thing, but I remember when the original videos, when they came out with it, that was exactly the kind of scenario that they were marketing. I think having a screen like that as a home base that isn't the TV, I think there is some real potential there, because right now we're used to sort of, you know, everything's in the laptop, but it's not really a shared experience. It's not what you're using. And then if otherwise you have the TV, but that's a very kind of sit down and, you know, a passive experience. this kind of thing, I agree with you, has the potential to become the new kind of gathering place, because, you know, games and that kind of stuff, I mean, they're kind of trapped in the analog world. I mean, right now, you know, you have your game closet with Sorry and Monopoly and whatever else. And just think if you had, like, you know, your subscription service for this thing where you have every board game ever made at, ready for you at this thing. I mean, that kind of value, I mean, you know, I could see that being a very big potential market, again, that, I, you know, remains untapped. And if you guys want to do a Kickstarter later, let me know.
We're going into the security business instead. But if that doesn't work out, maybe we'll go into the coffee table business with you. And, of course, it has to be mentioned that this thing will run Flappy Bird. So right there, yeah, it's worth the price of admission.
Absolutely. Boom.
Pete Paschal writes at Mashable.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Pete Paschal. That's P-A-C-H-A-L. Thank you so much for joining us on Two Stories.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care. Well, Joe, it looks like the YouTube music service has been identified in both name and some functions.
Sure does. And we've got the person who's really been pushing this story forward. We've got Lane Spradlin, the editor of Android Police, on the line with us. Good to have you along. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, can you give us the big picture to start with? What exactly is this service called, and when can we expect it?
So I don't have an answer to your second question, but I will say that the service is called YouTube Music Key. And we've known for a while that YouTube's going to come out with a subscription kind of music-centered service. And so this is it.
So and can you give us some additional details? Like, for example, you know, how much will it cost? What sort of offerings? And more particularly, what kind of music service will they provide that's unique that can't be found on other services?
Sure. So the service is expected to be $9.99 a month with a 30-day free trial, kind of like how Play Music All Access debuted. It's offering essentially offline or background playback for YouTube, plus it's ad-free, which is obviously one of the big draws. But the other big draw is that Google's kind of leveraging their YouTube model of creation and curation, in which they've already managed to create mixes by themselves, but also it's so easy for content creators to upload things like remixes and concert footage and things like that they're going to include in Music Key, which you can't really find on other streaming services yet.
So will this be just an audio service, or will there be some video mixed in?
Our understanding is that it will be video, but the features that they're adding on will make it so that you can listen to music in the background without having the YouTube app in focus per se. So if you're on your Android device and you start listening to a playlist on YouTube, you can quit and go to some other app and it'll still be playing in the background.
Now, I've been confused about this idea of a YouTube music service for some time, because as I understand it, licensing is a huge, huge deal. In fact, it's the governing limitation of Pandora and some of these other music services. You know, you go to Pandora and you listen to two or three songs and you're forwarding and like, oh, our licensing agreement doesn't allow us to let you listen anymore until you listen to some other songs or that sort of thing. And here they are. I always, you know, think of YouTube as a place where users upload content. How are they going to, be selling the content that's uploaded by users, or are they going to have licensing agreements for everything they sell?
The way I understand it is that a lot of the remixes and content that exists like that are already allowed by the copyright owners of the original work, and that those would probably be the things that Google's offering. So they're still able to use the kind of platform where anybody can upload anything, but I think they have to be more careful. And we have heard rumors that legal disputes, especially with indie labels, have come up and delayed this service a few times. So I'm sure that they've had a pretty tough time getting it going, which is probably why we haven't seen it yet.
Gotcha. So, you know, I'm a child of the 70s, and I loved concept albums from the 1970s, you know, Pink Floyd, those types of musicians. I'm wondering if we're going to see a return to music services or music that offers complete albums from the first track to the last track, and you sit down and listen to the entire thing rather than the one-off song. Any thoughts on that and how Google may attack that?
I think Google's definitely planning on taking that angle with YouTube Music Key. One of the screenshots that we posted actually explains that they've taken, I think, 20 million tracks and organized them into discographies where you can go to the album or the artist's whole collection and kind of listen at your leisure to any selection of that.
Liam Sprodlin writes at androidpolice.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Liam Sprodlin. Great scoop, Liam. Thank you so much for joining us on Tech News Today.
Thanks again for having me.
All right. Well, think of the children. That's what Google is doing, apparently. The company plans to offer Google accounts for kids under the age of 13. The special accounts would be set up by parents and offer Gmail and YouTube with parental controls, according to an exclusive on the site. Yeah, on the site, the information, as if people under the age of 13 use email. I don't think they do. Jeff John Roberts writes about law and public policy for GigaOM and joins us now. Welcome, Jeff John Roberts.
Hi, Mike. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Now, on the one hand, the move would probably provide data collection protection and parental controls for kids who are already using these services by lying about their age, especially YouTube. On the other hand, it represents Google targeting children and winning brand loyalty from minors, which kind of gives me the creeps. Do you think this is a good idea or a bad idea, looking at it from the big picture?
Well, from a Google growth perspective, it's a good idea because there's millions of people 13 and younger who probably use Google already and many more who could. And if you can inculcate them into using it with their parents on board, it's probably a very good way to get your hooks into them early. From a sort of policy perspective, yeah, it's a little creepy, but I can understand why Google's doing this.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, speaking of policy, do you think the FTC or any other government agencies are going to take a look at this?
Oh, they'll watch it real closely. I mean, it's something Google's going to have to tread very carefully because right now kids' privacy is a hot topic. The FTC is sort of trying to flex its muscle on privacy. So for Google to go forward, they better be very, very careful. But Google is big enough. They have the lawyers, the legal department to do it. And the thing is, you can have children under 13 subscribe, but you need parental consent. Most companies don't want to deal with that because you have to prove it. And the process for doing so is onerous. You have to show a written letter or phone up a hotline, things like that. And only a big company could handle that sort of regulatory headache. And if they mess it up, only a big company can afford the fine if they do that.
Now, the big challenge is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA. What is this Protection Act exactly? What does it require of companies like Google?
It says you can't retain data of people 13 or below. The reason a lot of people 13 or below are using Google or Facebook anyways is if there's sort of plausible deniability, if the website puts it up and simply says, we don't know, but if there's any sort of indication that the company does know, perhaps by asking age or something like that, then you can get in big trouble. And as some have pointed out, the reason Google's probably doing this is because there's all these young Android users out there, and there's nothing that Google hates more than to have a user without getting their data. And on that grounds, I think probably someone in Google said, okay, it's time to start onboarding these young Android users.
It's kind of like the Ronald McDonald approach to customer acquisition, where you get them while they're young, you get them to form their preferences and habits, and then they eventually become adults who buy stuff. And as soon as they turn 13, throw a big lever and suddenly start harvesting their data just like everybody else. Now, it's an interesting story. We're going to be watching this to see how this comes about. And I have the feeling that other companies, you mentioned that they have the deep pockets to do this and to deal with the lawyers and the regulation and all of that. I imagine that other companies are pretty happy with kids just lying about their age because it enables them to harvest data, but they're still covered by the law because they have set up this requirement and they have the users promise that they're old enough and so on. And so that kind of is the status quo right now, and it's probably working for the companies that don't want to deal with this type of regulation, as you mentioned. But I just really quickly wanted to ask you about another story you wrote today, which is about how the European Union is accusing Google of distorting the right to be forgotten. Now, we've talked a lot about the right to be forgotten debate. That's the European Union's regulation that requires search engines like Google, like Microsoft's Bing, like Yahoo, and so on, to have a process where European citizens can petition to have their name not be used as a search result or a search query to get certain types of data. For example, the quintessential example that started all this was a Spanish citizen who had financial problems. He later fixed those problems, but then it still looked like he was some kind of a deadbeat or whatever. So he went to court over this. And so in that case, he would have the right for when somebody searches for his name to not get the information that showed his financial problems years ago. So can you tell us a little bit, just briefly, Jeff, about what the European Union is accusing Google of?
Yeah, that's very interesting you point that out. On the heels of, on one hand, in North America, we have Google trying to get more data from ever younger people, but the tension in Europe is going the other way. It's, as you described it very well, simply the right to be forgotten and to purge Google search results. Basically, what the EU is doing is accusing Google of throwing wrenches and making this out to be a bigger deal than it is. On this one, I'm somewhat sympathized with Google because the court decision was very unspecific, and they simply said, okay, here's the rules. You have to delete people if they ask you to, unless it's in the public interest. Now, Google, you go figure it out, and which is a very complicated, difficult thing to do. So I think both the British press, British politicians, and Google have really raised the alarm. But in EU, especially in France and Germany, Google bashing is a popular sport. So in this sense, I think this is just simply another European politician making some hay by kicking Google around. But the underlying issue of how and when to delete your data from Google is still percolating.
Jeff John Roberts writes at GigaOhm.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jeff John Roberts. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks, Mike. Have a good one.
All right. Well, Joe, it looks like Symantec is consolidating their old Norton utility suite.
Yeah. You know what? One of the best known brands in software is finally waking up to the 21st century is the way I look at it. You know, Mike, we've seen Microsoft with the Office 365 cloud service make big subscription moves over the years. And then Adobe, of course, has made big subscription moves over the year. And finally now, Symantec with Norton is making some big subscription moves. So interesting to track this. And the real expert here is Harry McCracken, technology editor over at Fast Company. Harry, are you able to join us today and talk a little bit about what Symantec's doing here?
Hey, folks. Absolutely.
Fantastic. So give us the big picture. Step by step here, what are the pure facts so far in terms of what Symantec's up to with Norton?
Well, up until now, there have been a bunch of different variants of Norton's security products. There's been Norton 360, there's been Norton Antivirus, there's been Norton One, they've had mobile products, and they are consolidating all of them into one service. So basically, you pay one price, it's an annual subscription rather than a standalone price for a piece of box software, and you're entitled to install everything on up to five computers for $80. And also it applies to their mobile products as well. So it's all you can eat, annual price, rather than single price that you choose to pay when you want to upgrade.
Is this just cosmetics and also essentially the process for making it cloud-based, or have they actually simplified anything here?
They're also doing new versions. The general complaint with security software is sometimes it gets in your face and is annoying. And this is all happening this fall. And when they do it, they're releasing a new version of the interface, which they say is streamlined.
So, Harry, you know, Symantec has had a CEO change in the past year, give or take. They've been hit and miss on Wall Street. Do you see the DNA of the company changing and modernizing? I mean, when I heard about this move and read your coverage, my first reaction was, wow, this is way late. But on the other hand, maybe they are truly going to simplify. What's your take on the overall company move here?
Well, like you said, Norton is one of the most famous, longstanding brand names in software. It goes back to the early 80s. In the PC era, it was really important because your primary computing device was a Windows computer, and it desperately needed security software. I think it's been a challenge for Symantec to figure out what to do with Norton, given that PC sales are sluggish. They can do security software for Android, but on iOS, they couldn't even write conventional Norton products if they wanted to. I think a lot of this is figuring out about where they take this brand name. They're also pretty upfront about the fact that this could be good for Symantec's bottom line because currently they're still selling products individually and people don't always upgrade them. And this is trying to shift Norton to a model where you pay between $80 and $90 to Symantec every year. And every year they automatically charge you for that update. So in theory, it should be good to their bottom line if it's a model that consumers are okay with. I think there are a lot of consumers who their immediate response to this will be they want to decide when to do the upgrade, and they don't like the idea of paying every year for everything. Mm. On the other hand, though, security software is a little different from something like an Office suite or products like Adobe do, in that if you're using security software at all, you really do want to be current, because if you aren't, your computer won't be protected against the latest threats.
Now, they also introduced a money-back guarantee. How do you know if it didn't work? If all your data is stolen and everything is erased, then you get your money back? Or how would you know if the security suite isn't protecting you?
Well, basically, the notion is that you will get an alert if there's a problem. And if the Norton software can't automatically remove that threat, you'll call Norton's tech support line, and a real person will walk you through removing it. And if that real person fails to do it, then you get your money back. Of course, if your computer really does get attacked by a virus and your data does get lost, I think the $80 you paid to Norton is probably going to be the last thing on your mind. But the notion is that if you get an alert, Norton will let you remove that threat.
Harry McCracken writes at fastcompany.com, and you can find him also at technologizer.com, and follow him on Twitter at Harry McCracken. Now, Harry, this is the first time we've had you on the show since you started at Fast Company. How's that going for you?
It's a lot of fun. I'm doing a lot of the same kind of stuff I did when I worked for Time, and also doing some new things as well.
Wonderful. It's great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, in an exclusive, The Register is reporting today that London's Metropolitan Police have been lobbying phone makers for more than 2 years to ship all smartphones locked with passcodes right out of the box. The purpose of the move is to deter theft. Now, research shows that 3 out of 5 people never set passcodes on their phone. Under the London Police's plan, each phone would either come with a preset PIN code or the setup would require users to set their own PIN code. Joe Panettiere, how much pull does the London Police Department have with the world's smartphone vendors?
Next to nothing. No, I don't know. I just think this is yet another case of the government overthinking things. Let the industry sort it out. Why the London Police would get involved is beyond me.
Yeah, they're just trying to, I guess they're trying to reduce crime. And of course, smartphone theft in London is actually, it's like the world's global epicenter for smartphone theft, or so I've read. Well, Joe, it looks like Apple has yet another pile of patents for us to sift through.
Yeah, a pile of patents, roughly 48 of them, apparently. And the one that's catching everyone's attention has something to do with a curved touch display. So, Mike, you can guess. Everyone's yep. thinking, oh, this has to do something with iWatch, or allegedly iWatch.
Yep. And we heard, you know, we were hearing about a curved glass smartwatch, what, 2 years ago, a year ago, 2 years ago? I mean, we've been talking about this for a long, long time. And, you know, I think I remember writing columns about this a couple of years ago.
Sure.
Because that's really the problem with smartwatches is that they're big, clunky, bulky. They have these big edges and corners, including the Android Wear devices that both Jason and I are wearing. It's not the size as much as it is the shape and the intrusiveness. You know, you knock them on the doorknobs or whatever when you're walking around. And so curved glass makes a ton of sense. It's not easy to do. And, of course, Apple is obsessed with curved glass. Their new spaceship headquarters, according to Steve yep. Jobs, doesn't have a single flat piece of glass in the entire building. And so they love the curved glass, and of course they're patenting that to the greatest extent possible. What else do they have in terms of patents that stood out to you?
Well, I think what really stood out to me here is the fact that we're hearing so much about patents lately from Apple, especially ahead of the September 9th iPhone 6 alleged launch. So I think it was a few weeks ago, Mike, you and I and the rest of the team, we covered the fact that Apple had earned some sort of patents that had to do with wearable computing. It almost looked like a mini iPod mini strapped to your wrist, you know? And to me, when that patent emerged, it almost felt like circa, you know, 2008. It was almost like that game had already been played out. And now you have this new curved touch display patent emerging among with 48 others. But to your point, Mike, you were estimating that you've been covering this for roughly 2 years. It looks like these patents were filed for back in the 2010 timeframe. They're just coming to light now. Patently, Apple has the complete scoop. I think it may be a coincidence that it's all coming to light in terms of spilling out onto the web right ahead of the iPhone 6 launch. I'm trying not to reach that conclusion that we're going to see all this news at that launch on September 9th. But the news just keeps on coming ahead of that event date.
It does. And I'm also seeing chatter that to the iWatch may have been pushed back to 2015. It's a typical coming into an Apple announcement. You have rumors that say X, and you have another rumor that says not X, and you just don't know what to believe until you get there. We do know that Apple's building a watch. We just don't know when. And we do know that Apple loves curved glass, and they have intention to build curved glass devices. We don't know when. And so they're a very slow-moving company, so we may not see any of this stuff for a little while. But they do have the patents, and again, has to be said that some of their patents never see the light of day. They like to do just in case kind of patents because that's a smart thing to do.
Would Apple ever, I think the answer to this is no, but would they ever build a display into their Magic Mouse? Because that kind of looks like a Magic Mouse to me.
I wouldn't put it past them. I don't know why they would do
that.
I don't know either,
but who knows?
Well, you should file a feature request.
There we go.
I want a display, maybe show cartoons and Flappy Bird right there.
Exactly.
That'd be great.
Second screen, right?
How about a second button? We got an email from Lillian Banchek, who's a doctor, about our story yesterday on that big hospital hack. The personal information of something like 4.5 million people was compromised when a healthcare company called Community Health Systems was hacked. And here's what she wrote in her email. I think you missed one of the primary motives for the theft of those medical records. In my opinion, it was done to raise money, pure and simple, by the sale of false identities, both civil and medical. This is a crime where someone fraudulently uses your health insurance information to obtain medical coverage. For example, and this comes from my own practice, I had a patient who was an undocumented person and presented with severe abdominal pain, afraid of being arrested and deported. This person used a relative's insurance card and claimed to be that person. We relied on that identification and looked up the relative's medical record, which showed that the person already had an appendectomy. The patient had an abdominal scar from another procedure, so a simple exam couldn't have established the appendix was still there. By the time we realized what was going on, the patient had become much sicker, and he/she would have been if we had known that the appendix was still there and had just gone ahead with the surgery. So that's kind of a scary idea. That would probably rule out the Chinese army if the motive, in fact, was selling for money, this sort of health information. But it is a scary thing that people would be using somebody else's health medical records that they purchased on the black market. And we thank you for that email. Well, in a few follow-ups, we have some very quick follow-ups. We reported the introduction of the LG G Watch, which runs Google's Android Wear operating system. But now, the Korea Times newspaper in Korea, of course, is reporting that LG could introduce version 2 of the watch at the IFA conference in Germany next month. That'd be right on the heels of the Moto 360 launch, which we're expecting early in the month next month. We also reported Friday on Samsung's acquisition of SmartThings to boost its home automation lineup. And today, Samsung said they've acquired an American air conditioning distributor called QuietSide. That's pretty cool. Air conditioning. Nothing's cooler than air conditioning. Also, we've extensively covered Amazon's first smartphone, the Amazon Fire Phone, which shipped July 25th. Yesterday, the phone got a major update, the Fire OS 3.5.1, which reviewers are saying fixes many of the phone's fundamental flaws. So suddenly, the phone is much better, and the update downloads and installs automatically. And in other news, a new website exists to name and shame companies that use bad security. The site is written and published by software engineer Tony Webster, and it's called HTTP Shaming. It exposes companies that send customer information over the internet in an unencrypted form, and he's already identified 19 applications and services that deserve our scorn and ridicule, and now he's accepting reader submissions. You can check it out at httpshaming.tumblr.com. Of course, it's a Tumblr. And our TNT fan of the day is Douglas Dewing in the state of Oregon, who posted this picture in the Tech News Today Google Plus community. Take a look at that. And there's Joe Panettiere. Look at that. Wow.
On the big screen, maybe on a coffee table somewhere.
Yeah, call it the Joe Show. Look at that. That is a very large TV. And that's a great way to consume Tech News Today. Well, that is the Tech News Today. And Joe Panettiere, I want to thank you for being our co-anchor today and every Tuesday.
It's always great to be here. Thanks to you and Jason for having me.
All right. Well, thanks again. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, RSS, and Yahoo. So many options. I think RSS, I'm a big believer in RSS. That's a great way to subscribe. You can choose your favorite way at twit.tv/TNT. Follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and please send us your thoughts and opinions. Send email to tnt@twit.tv, leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW, and don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.